Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Paul Theroux, whose latest travel book is titled Ghost Train to the Eastern Star, On the Tracks of the Great Railway Bazaar. Recent books include the novel Blinding Light, the collection of three novellas, The Elephanta Suite. Earlier books include Dark Star Safaris, Cervidia's Shadow. Paul Theroux, what prompted you to travel again on the route that you traveled on in 1973?
It was really the sense that a revisit is a revelation. We spoke 5 years ago. I talked about Dark Star Safari. That book was coming out. It's a trip from Cairo to Cape Town. You know, wonderful trip down the Nile, through the Sudan, through Ethiopia, Rambo's Harar, Kenya, and so forth. But the part of that trip that interested me most, that really held me, was revisiting the school that I had taught in 30 years earlier in the Peace Corps in the middle of Malawi. The rest of Africa was all new and wonderful. I hadn't been to the Sudan before. But seeing something that I knew well, people I knew well, I spoke the language in Malawi, and this school that I had taught in, I thought, so this is what happens with 35 years of aid, help, save the children, Peace Corps, five-year plans, money, and the interference of reformers and aid workers. And you see what time does to a place and what time had done to me. That was the bright spot in that book. It was dark for some people because they think, oh, my God, what happened? But it taught me something. I thought, going back to my first travel back on the rails again and seeing people in places that I'd seen before, I'd have some background. I'd have a frame for it, and I'd be able to assess it better.
One difference, which you've talked about, but it's also in the book, is that in that first book, you kept your personal life out of it, and which was falling apart at the time. So that's changed in you. You're no longer afraid of that. Paul Theroux is more Paul Theroux in this book than, say, you were 35 years ago.
That's so true. But, see, I think I was just over 30 years old when I wrote The Great Railway Bazaar. In my 30s, and even into my 40s, I didn't know how to write about my life. You need perspective. You need time. It's the time. This is the travel in the fourth dimension, writing in the fourth dimension. You start out writing about other people or disguising yourself in other people. I wrote Picture Palace. It's narrated by a woman. That came out in 78, a woman photographer in her picture palace. What man today would sit down and write a book about a woman photographer in her voice? You know, it's just not done. I was writing about myself. I was writing about creativity and the oddness of the creative process. But I was doing things in my earlier life, trying to find ways. I mean, I was kind of in a closet almost, which writers are. I mean, some just write about themselves. They just have nothing else to write about. But I thought, writing is about other people, other places, not about me. You know, when my marriage was falling apart, writing The Great Railway Bazaar, I didn't have the guts. I didn't have the perspective. I didn't have the nerve to write about it. I didn't know how to write about it. So the book is kind of determinedly cheerful, you know, and crazy. That's probably accounts for it. Is a kind of a crazy book, The Great Railway Bazaar.
What do you think the breakthrough was, My Secret History?
Probably My Secret History, because I called it My Secret History, I thought, well, this is about me. I wrote about being an altar boy, or about affairs with women, and I even wrote about marital discord in it. Yeah, so it was probably that. My wife at the time wasn't happy about the book, but it was probably that, yeah. And regarding my life as my secret history and everything else as public knowledge. I mean, the trouble with writing about yourself is you're spending your capital. So you write about it, and then you can quickly run through that material. Then it just becomes variations on a theme. It's kind of a dangerous thing to do. I think it was odd, who used that expression, spending your capital.
Paul Theroux, Ghost Train to the Eastern Star, let's give it a context. I know that even though this book and your other books, it feels like it's one trip. Frequently, it's more than one trip. Broken up. I mean, you said Dark Star Safari, I think, was like three trips or something?
It was, yeah. It was really, well, two and a half. Yeah.
Two and a half. How many was this?
It was two long trips in the middle of it. I went really from London to Turkey, then through the stands, through India, at Vietnam, into China, to Japan. Now, I live in Hawaii most of the year. So Japan is very near Hawaii. If you're sitting in Japan, you think, okay, continue through Japan, up and down Japan in the winter, and then take the Trans-Siberian to London, the opposite direction from why, you know, what would you do? The other thing is that I had a colonoscopy scheduled. See, my age, it's not just travel and getting drunk and going to, it's also things like colonoscopy. I'm the same age as Dick Cheney, so I got to think about these things. So I actually went from London to Tokyo, flew to Hawaii, got a colonoscopy, chilled a little, and then I went back and resumed the trip.
How long was the sojourn in Hawaii? About a month?
Yeah, no, it was a little more than that. It was about 6 weeks, I think, and then carried on. But the early part of the trip really took a long time. I mean, that was the other thing about the Great Railway Bazaar trip. It was 3.5, almost 4 months of just steady travel. At the end of that, I was almost insane, I thought. You know, I got home. If I had never taken a trip before like that. I didn't know what the book would be like. I was homesick. My wife had taken up with another guy. You know, I thought, everything's going wrong here. That was very hard. You can take trips, lots of people do, but if it's too long, you come back, you're Rip Van Winkle. I'm a committed traveler, but, you know, I'm not a masochist. Also, you know, that's months and months away, traveling alone. You take someone like Graham Greene in Africa, you think, oh, my God, it's Heart of Darkness. It's not. You know, Greene went with his cousin to write Journey Without Maps. He was on his trip for 18 days. 18 days traveling, you know, it's like an epic walk. 18 days walk. And his book about Mexico is 6 weeks. So compared to that, you know, I'm a hardy person.
Before we get to some of your sites along the way, a couple of things. One of which, and you talk about it in the book, is the change that you experienced being young first time and older. You talk about the older traveler being invisible, and also that the older traveler has a sense of life that the younger traveler doesn't have, kind of an overarching theme of their life that they can view the world through.
Yeah, that's true. I think as you get older, you realize that really one of the gifts is that people stop looking at you. They stop expecting anything from you. They really think that you're not all there. You're not really sentient. You're just an old buffer. I don't feel like an old buffer. As a matter of fact, you know, I could still cut the mustard and do push-ups and ride a bike and paddle a kayak. But I guess I don't look that way. The gift is that you're a spectral being as an older person. I'm in my late 60s. As I said, I'm Dick Cheney. I don't look like Dick Cheney, thank God. But I'm able at this age to look on as though through a window at what's happening. No one's sort of interacting with me necessarily, but I'm in that ideal position that a writer's in as an eavesdropper. I can be even close to the action, but no one's paying any attention to me. In fact, no one's trying to rob me either. No one's trying to sell me something. No one's trying to fall in love with me. So that's actually ideal, that you're at the periphery of action. And I think older people realize that. I've also seen things. I've been here before in these places as an older person, as a returning traveler, and they don't know that either. So young people tell older people things that they know already. I mean, that's the irritating thing. The trouble is when older people say that, they sound like an old fogey. So you don't want to sound like a fogey.
How about the fact that you're going over the same route that you went over and the route that actually made you a successful writer? There are several times where people recognize you. There's one case on a train where you see someone reading your own book.
Oh, yeah, that's always fun. I wasn't recognized much. You know, every so often someone does say, oh, you're the writer. But in general, people don't read a lot. They don't read as much as they say they do. So that doesn't happen a lot. Seeing someone reading your book on a train, I mean, I was sort of criticized for pointing this out, but it is kind of a fun thing that you're on a train in a remote place. It happened to be in southern Thailand. And there's a backpacker reading The Mosquito Coast, and I'm sitting next to her across the aisle and just watching her read. It's a, you know, for a writer, that's a thrill. That's just a great thing. I don't know whether other writers have mentioned this, but I'm just staring at it and watching her turn the pages, and she was turning the pages, and at the end said, you know, by the way, I wrote that. Or did you like it? And I wrote it. That's not a narcissistic thing. That's an episode. When you're writing, you're looking for things to happen. You want things to happen, and you want to report on what's happening.
The trip itself, you start in London and go through Paris. And, of course, at that point, a lot of people have been on that part of the trip. And it isn't really until you go through Eastern Europe by train and arrive in Istanbul and go through Turkey that you're beginning to go into areas that most people don't. Your sojourn in Istanbul included a long talk that you had with Orhan Pamuk, the Nobel Prize winner who's been on this program. When you're in Istanbul, were you able, in the same way that, let's say, when you were in Japan with Murakami, to kind of see his city through his eyes?
I saw the city through his eyes, through Pamuk's eyes, by actually reading his book, Istanbul.
Which is supposed to be very good.
It's an excellent book. It's an excellent book. Because he loves the city. He lived there his whole life. He has no ambition to live anywhere else. He's not going to, you know, Milan Kundera lives in Paris. There's an Albanian writer called Ismail Kadare who lives in Paris. He doesn't live in Albania. So many people just say, get successful and go somewhere else, say in Europe. Pamuk is a, what he called Istanbulu. He's a just an inhabitant of Istanbul. But earlier, can I just return to something in your prologue? You said traveling through familiar territory from London to Paris and then onward. It's true that lots of people have done that. The hardest thing to write is the familiar. It's a great challenge to write about home, the well-beaten path. I found a book by Ford Madox Ford about London called The Soul of London. And he talks about entering London, leaving London. It was one of his first, if not perhaps his first book, I think 1905, I'm not mistaken, it might be earlier than that. When I took the Great Railway Bazaar trip, I wrote about leaving London, going to Folkestone, going to Boulogne, and then onward. And I thought, I'm a writer, I'm going to write about every phase of this trip. But anyway, to return to the latter part of the question, to be with a national writer in his country is the most wonderful thing. To be with Borges in Buenos Aires, I had that thrill, which is a real thrill. I mean, I think writers are magical people, older writers, really committed writers. They're magic. The hacks leave the hacks. J.K. Rowling once said she doesn't believe in magic. I don't want to talk to her. I want to talk to a person who writes about magic, who believes in magic, a person who inhabits their own country, Murakami living in Japan and totally committed. Japanese writer, writes in Japan, doesn't move to Paris. So I was with Murakami in Tokyo, with Pamuk in Istanbul, with Arthur C. Clarke, whose heart was, he died a few months ago, but his heart was in Sri Lanka, believed in it, loved it, lived there since the 50s. That's what I need, that kind of passion. You know, I'm not dissing J.K. Rowling, but what's the story? I mean, it's just a kiddie, but that's just making up stories. I mean, she's a hack. Tolkien, if you were comparing, actually believed what he was writing. There was a hobbit-like temperament that he actually had. You would love to have talked to him. I mean, he totally believed. And he was unhappily married and actually, I suppose, kind of a morose person. Not a successful writer, but a successful professor of Anglo-Saxon and so forth. So anyway, so you want the passion of the committed writer.
Before we go on, let me ask you this. I know in Hotel Honolulu you've written about Hawaii. Could you see yourself writing, or is it just too close, writing a travel book in a way about, say, Oahu, where you live?
It would be very hard to do because I live there and because it's so familiar. And it's also, writing is a way of making yourself unpopular. So if you write about, when I lived in England for a while, and I wrote The Kingdom by the Sea. I won't say it made me enemies, but you write about people who are reading the book. Everyone who lived in England in a particular place read about their place. If I wrote about Aberdeen, they read about Aberdeen. They read that chapter and hated it because the book was critical. I wrote about the English or the British, the way they had been writing about other people, sniffily, you know, odd, colorful little people. I thought, well, I want to write this book. So you write about home, and you're in a precarious position. So I've resisted that. Although Hotel Honolulu, you know, I saw the movie rights to that. The movie has been made, but it was a risk. It's a risky thing to do. But I did want to understand the society. I thought the way Hawaii is written about is not true. It's a much more complex, much more difficult, much more abrasive place than it's ever given credit for. It's seen as kind of Happy Valley. Well, it's not.
No.
It's a Pacific island with a traffic problem and a race problem, too. It's multiracial, but there's not much melting. That makes it more interesting to write about, not less. You know, if it was such a harmonious place, you wouldn't be able to write about it. You can't write about harmonious places. Bali, I think, has not produced that many great books. There are a couple of good ones, but that is a harmonious place on the whole. Hawaii is not.
Well, speaking of non-harmonious places, once you get past Turkey, then we enter the area known as the Stans. Turkmenistan, which hopefully is slightly different than when you were there. Uzbekistan. It sounds pretty scary to be going into areas where governments are ruled by madmen, bandits, terrorists out there. And you're just an aging traveler on a train.
It's true that I'm really out of my depth in a lot of these places. Georgia, I found weird. You go from a familiar place like Turkey, familiar and a tractable place with good food and hospitable people, and then traveling from there into Georgia on a Boston train through Gori, Tbilisi, I found that odd because I unexpected, just sort of a very decaying hinterland with quite a nice city, Tbilisi. Azerbaijan, Turkmenistan. Turkmenistan is people speak Turkmen. I'm not familiar with this language, or Russian, but not many people speak Russian. Uzbek was not in my high school, even college course. Yeah, flying by the seat of my pants in these places. As far as danger, you're subject to the hospitality of strangers. You're Blanche DuBois in situations like that and just hoping that good things will happen. I think that there's an element of risk or an element of suspension of disbelief. Say, crossing a border from Turkmenistan into Uzbekistan. I remember waiting in the rain by a fence just with a lot of Turkmen and Uzbeks, and then walking across the border, and then walking through no man's land, and then seeing an old car and saying to the guy, what's your name? Fuad, can you take me to Bukhara? His door was jammed shut. You crawl through the window, and he's going, and I'm thinking, this guy could pull off the road and rob me and just leave me there. But he didn't. I mean, in Africa, I had the same problem. As a traveler, you're just at the mercy of other people. But most people were okay. I really was only threatened a few times, and usually by drunks, and I wasn't robbed. It's true that there's risk, but if there's no risk, then really there's no reward, there's no book. So if I wanted to go and not take risks, I'd go to the south of France and have pâté de foie gras and write about Somerset Maugham.
Well, there's an interesting point you raised there. If there hadn't been a book, could you have even conceived of taking this trip? If you knew you weren't going to be writing about it?
I've taken many trips. I've only kept a travel diary or a journal. Many trips. Many, many. And maybe wrote an article about it or something. As far as a book, if I hadn't known, say, in the first third of the trip, that I had enough material to write a book, I would have gone home. I would have thought, you know, I'm just repeating myself. There's nothing here. And I'll give you an example. I went to Brazil about 6 or 7 years ago, and I thought, I've dreamt about Brazil. I've always wanted to go to Brazil. It seemed multicultural, jungle, people naked on the beach. I went and I traveled up and down Brazil thinking this would be a great subject for a travel book or a novel, and the place defeated me. I didn't speak Portuguese. I could speak Italian. It helped in a few places, but Brazil was too big, too various, too messy, too catastrophic for me to write about. So I abandoned the project.
You're listening to an interview with Paul Theroux, whose latest book is Ghost Train to the Eastern Star. American exceptionalism has been the rule around the world for quite a while. Americans have tended to be treated differently. The Bush administration, 8 years of relentless, as you would call it, bad government. Have you noticed any difference in how you're treated as an American around the world? I know people despise Bush. You said in the book that only two people had anything good to say about this man of everyone you talked to.
Two self-interested people, yeah. That's right. Guy in Azerbaijan, memorably, we like Bush because we want him to bomb Iran. That's the reason for liking Bush. Not a great reason. Are Americans treated differently is a good question. I think in some places, probably Europe, they are, but just because Europeans can be so sniffy about Americans. The French might, the Germans might. Italians, maybe, although I was in Italy and I didn't get any guff from them. The British, to a certain degree, they make a profession. You know, E.B. White said, an Englishman is not happy until he's explained America. In Asia, no. In Azerbaijan, the rest of the people, fine. Turkmenistan, no. No guff. They have the problems with other people. The Turkmen have it with the Russians. The Georgians have it with the Russians. The Indians have it with the Pakistanis. The Burmese have it with their own government. Even in Vietnam, we dropped 7 million tons of bombs on Vietnam. You don't hear bad things about America. They want to do business with us. And they say that was another time. That was your government that did it. And I think also most people are so badly governed themselves, they figure, we're in the same boat as you. At last, you know, you don't have a wise old statesman running it. You have a bum just like we have. And you're up against the same thing. Or there's this other question, which is, Yankee, go home, but please take me with you. There's this thing of, you may have a bad government, but America is the last best hope for a lot of people. It's the mothership. It's the rescue. People can even hate Bush and feel that a lot of bad things are happening in the world because of America, and yet are dying to come to America. So there's that big contradiction, too. Personally, I never felt that anyone was hassling me. And I lived through the Vietnam War in Africa and Southeast Asia, and believe me, in Africa, I've never had more crap thrown at me than living in Africa and people talking about Vietnam and me personally having to explain what we were doing in Vietnam. It was awful, awful. The 60s were like that. The whole of the 60s, people holding me personally responsible for the bombing of Hanoi.
American culture, what was it like in places like Turkmenistan or Georgia or, I know a lot of Americans were over in Georgia after the Soviet Union fell apart, or even in India. Is there much penetration of American culture there in India, which has its own huge, for instance, film system?
Yes, there is a lot. I mean, first, there's a whole level of Indian society which is very attuned both to American culture and to American technology, not as much as people make out. But, I mean, there are people who just understand the computer systems and what we're doing in technology. That actually allows them to access American culture, music, movies, and everything. If you have a successful book in the States or a successful movie, it will be pirated in India within days and start showing up in the bazaars. The internet cafes and computers proliferate, not in Turkmenistan, not so much in Uzbekistan, but certainly in India and Azerbaijan and other places, in Vietnam too. The computer has allowed all this to happen. So American culture, when I took the Great Railway Bazaar trip in Iran, people were badgering me to sell them my blue jeans. They wanted to buy blue. Having blue jeans was a very big deal in 1973 in my shed in northeastern Iran. And I remember selling a pair for $10 or $15, which was, you know, that was enough money to get me into Afghanistan and Kandahar by road. But now everyone's got blue jeans. People wanted watches then. Everyone's got a watch. So American culture, everyone dresses like Americans. The whole world. In Italy, if you go to Italy, you see them wearing T-shirts, sneakers, blue jeans. You know, that's kind of normal. In the 70s and 60s when I was there, you know, men wore brown suits and women wore black dresses.
One of the salient points that really got me by the end of the trip when I finished the book is the regionalism in cities. It's like, you know, in some respects, Singapore doesn't sound that much different from Tokyo, which in some respects isn't that different. I mean, it's a Japanese, you know, Tokyo is a Japanese overlay on Times Square, let's say, but there's a similarity. It's almost as if the world and the different corners are starting to disappear.
Well, I agree with the earlier observation, which is the cities are connected. So Bombay is a city of 20 million. Tokyo is a city of 22 million. Singapore doesn't have that many people, but it's connected. They have airports. You can fly from Bombay to New York to San Francisco very easily, simply. But the corners still exist. I mean, the corners in India are both remote, some of them hermetic, extremely cut off, and they don't in the least resemble their cities. So if you are saying that the cities have become resemble each other, which I think that's true, and are very accessible. I mean, you meet people in Delhi who have relatives in Chicago, you meet people in Singapore who have relatives in San Francisco. And so this easy familiarity with the world is true of the urban population. But the rural populations of these places are still very much, in many cases, cut off, hard to get to. And, I mean, the suicide rate in central India is very high. They can't pay their debts. People don't know how to get jobs. They're running out of money. They're running out of hope. The rural poor of the world are cut off, and they're not sharing the urban dream of a lot of the people. They don't even know how to get there. So I think there is a lot of regionalism. I think, and that actually is the thing that makes travel rewarding, that you can find places that haven't been seriously penetrated.
One of the things reading all of your books is this notion of the train. You know, we're all so used to the airplane. Maybe now times are changing, and God knows buses are ghastly. But the train goes on, and I keep thinking that if I were to just throw everything away and just go travel, train would be the way to go?
Yeah, it would be. It is pretty good. I was in Santa Barbara taking a walk just the other day, and I walked down to the railway station, and I was thinking, you know, I got to come to San Francisco, but I could have gone on the train there, no hassle, no metal detector, no shoes off, just get on the train, come to San Francisco and talk to you. I had something to do, so it wasn't possible. You can get off a train at any moment. You can bring all your stuff on. No one in a train station is saying, we are now at threat level one, as someone said at San Francisco Airport, in fact, just the other day. That's like a science fiction film. It's like a horror of dystopia. We are at threat level one. They don't say it in railway stations. You show up at a railway station 15 minutes before the train, get on and off you go. So it's true. And actually, it's being revived because of the gas crisis and all the rest of it. It is a great way to go. And the other thing is that if you're writing a travel book, as I am, you need some way to pull it, a thread to pull it together. So the train was in this book and in other books of mine.
When you're on the train, you're also able to look out the window and see changes.
I think of it in London, that if you're on a road in London, you're traveling down the high street. When you're on a train, you're traveling behind the houses, and you see the gardens, you see the children playing, you see the back of the school, the back of the shop, you see the backs of things where real life is lived. You see people hanging out laundry. No one hangs out laundry on the main street. They do it behind the house. You can look through windows. So it's true. It gives you the underside, the behind, the dark beyond of life being lived. And you're standing up. You can stand up on a train. In a car, you're in a seat. You're strapped in a seat. You're looking out the window, kind of twisting your neck sideways. But on a train, you're walking around. You're looking out the window. And you're standing, leaning against the window, making notes. And there's a big difference there, just in your posture.
When I was in Tokyo 3 years ago, taking the Circle Line, the above-ground Circle Line, it's that same feeling. You're getting a sense of the city that you can't get in any other way.
It's true. When I was a boy, growing up in Medford, Massachusetts, we used to take the train into Boston, the bus to Sullivan Square and then the train. And I remember taking the train from Sullivan Square to North Station and beyond. It was an elevated train, and we could look through people's windows. And I had never, you know, growing up in Medford, street level, but to be elevated and looking through windows, actually into people's houses, was kind of a thrill. Maybe that made me a writer, the idea, just looking through windows. And at night, or in the gathering darkness of winter, looking through a window that was lighted, so everything's darkness, you could actually see people in their pajamas, their clothes, or making, you know, half-dressed, making meals and so forth. It's kind of a thrill there, too. You're with people in a very hospitable setting, because you can eat, you can drink, you can walk around, you can sit with them, and you meet them in a much more intimate surrounding.
There's a point where you're talking to somebody on a train, and they begin asking you questions, at which point you get up and leave, because your goal is to hear them, not for them to hear you.
That's the problem with being identifiable. The Japanese writer Murakami doesn't appear on television in Tokyo and doesn't allow his face to be widely circulated in pictures and so forth, and does in interviews and so forth, so that he could keep his privacy. And I think that the thing that matters most, having your anonymity, and you can be anonymous in a train. I really don't want to answer questions about books. I like the idea that I'm not recognized, and I'm sure Murakami the same. I'm not the subject of this book. Other people are, I like to think.
Let's get back to a couple of places. One is Turkmenistan, which we don't know if it's the same now or different. I assume it's slightly different because Niyazov is dead now. Here's a place that's ruled by a madman who puts up gold statues of himself, and the rest of the country is just poor.
Not only poor, but unhoused. This man, Turkmenbashi, R.I.P., he died last December, I think, or so. Bulldozed houses, so there were homeless people. People with really no money, no jobs, and some people not able to go to universities there. It's not a multicultural place. So there are Russians living there. There are ethnic Koreans. Turkmenbashi, Niyazov. Turkmenbashi means leader of the Turkmen. He decided that he would just invent a new place or reclaim Turkmenistan. But he was insane, not healthy. He was also in his late 60s, and he decided just to name the days of the week after his mother, his father, himself. It was crazy, but people had to do it. He renamed the months. He eliminated the dictionary. He said there were too many non-Turkmen words in dictionary. Put up gold statues of himself, as you say, marble palaces, marble ministries. You know, if you have a lot of money, you have people helping you spend it. So he had architects and designers in there saying, well, why don't you do this? Why don't you do that? And so the place, as someone described it to me, looked like Pyongyang and Las Vegas mixed together in a big cocktail shaker. And
did you have much chance just walking around the city?
Yeah, I did. I walked around and I was driven around, tried to talk to people. But it was a tyranny, so people weren't very forthcoming, except on trains. I mean, I took the train from Ashgabat to Turkmenabad, $4 to take the overnight sleeper. And they were forthcoming. But on the whole, people really didn't want to talk too much about him. What they said was, this too will pass away. He'll go. We've seen tyrants before. You know, Stalin and Brezhnev and other, you know, the whole succession of Soviet leaders that had just used Turkmenistan as a place to get natural gas. That's the Trans-Caspian Railway. That railway went all the way to the Caspian Sea, to Baku, to the Black Sea, you know, straight across. It's a great old and venerable line. And the place itself was just the site of the Silk Road. It had great markets. It has the ancient ruins. So this crazy man, Turkmenbashi, had distorted and perverted the culture, and he died. And now a new man's there. The new man's called Gurbanguly Berdimuhamedow. Gurbanguly Berdimuhamedow took down some of these gold statues. He's a dentist. He was in the parliament. He'll be a tyrant of a different stripe, but probably not as crazy as Niyazov.
When you were there, I mean, just reading it is both horrifying and incredibly funny. I mean, there must have been moments where you were just wishing you could burst out laughing because this stuff doesn't exist. It's like science fiction.
No, it's a gift. For a traveler, it's a gift. You set off to write a book about your travels, as I did. They say, you can't go to Iran, you can't go to Afghanistan. And so I think, okay, I'll make a detour through Turkmenistan. What can that be like? I'll ask someone. No one knows. No one has a clue. So you're going into terra incognita, and that's kind of great. That's great because it's like you're like Columbus discovering the new world. You know, that's the thing that a traveler wants, discovery. And you come across this lunatic multi-billionaire spending money putting up gold statues. That's a gift. So that experience of Turkmenistan was really something highly desirable, uncomfortable, weird, unexpected kind of discoveries. I'm not that interested in going to the Taj Mahal, but places like Turkmenistan, very, very much.
What other places that are either in your book in great depth or not did that for you? Were you going, God, I'm glad I'm Paul Theroux right now?
That's a great question. The first place that comes to mind is Albania. I wrote The Pillars of Hercules, Trip Around the Mediterranean. So I saw a bullfight in Spain. I went to Alt, Van Gogh. I went through Italy, went through, Malta, Sicily. Then I got to Albania, and I thought, oh, my goodness, this is just perfect. So the chapter about Albania in The Pillars of Hercules is really one of my favorite chapters. It's just I went there, and I thought, I'm Alice through the looking glass. Weird. It had been isolated from the world for 35 or 40 years after the war. It had just developed on its own as beyond the third world. Isn't that, I mean, people who go to Africa, they say, oh, you know, Malawi's kind of strange or Zimbabwe's kind of strange. I thought, you haven't seen anything. Go to Albania. Well, it's different now. But I had gone there soon after it opened up. Burma, to a certain extent, I felt, God, there's so much to write about here. It's so odd. It's so cut off. Particularly now, you know, it's pretty much the same place as it was when I saw it in 73. But those three places come to mind, Burma, Turkmenistan, Albania. Albania, oh man. I'm proud of the Pillars of Hercules, but you write about the Mediterranean. You're writing about familiar places and sites and great monuments and so forth. That was the bright spot for me, the misery and horror of Albania.
As opposed to places where Americans go frequently, like Tokyo or even Thailand, where there's a lot of Farang now.
Yeah, there are a lot. There are people who have even dropped out or people who retired. I mean, people retired to Costa Rica, Americans. They retire to Thailand. They retire to the Philippines. You're in kind of American retirement communities where people are just tottering along. Or they're in the bars with, you know, with girls or boys or whatever it is and having great time spending their Social Security. There's a whole book in that, perhaps, about where you find a lot of Americans. But to find a place where there are no travelers, it's very hard to get a visa to Turkmenistan. I mean, almost impossible to get an individual visa. But I managed. I pulled a few strings. I met a guy, you know. He fixed it up. To go to a place that's off the map is really where you want to go.
Paul Theroux, here we are in 2008, and this happened winter 2006 to 7, right?
Yes, yeah.
During the period when the Democrats had taken over Congress.
Yeah.
I interviewed Gore Vidal then. He said, yes, it's good, but he added, you know, the little president, and I call him that, could do a lot of damage in 2 years. And as we find out now, yes. Okay, here we are now. Do you think those 2 years have changed the way people view America? Do you think we're entering the cusp of something new just from traveling around, or is this not even a question I should be asking you?
We don't know really how we got here, so we don't know what's to come. Everything hinges on this election, I think. Everything hinges on it. If McCain and Palin are elected, we'll have really more of this, of the Bush years. We'll have at least 4 years of the same stuff. I think a very bad economy. I think aggression around the world and bad mistakes. If Obama's elected, I think things will be different and we have a chance. I don't know whether people perceive America differently, but I must say we perceive ourselves differently. And everyone's got his heart in his mouth or her mouth. And we're thinking, what's to come? We don't know. We don't know. We're a diminished country. We're a poor country. We're $10 trillion in debt. And no one knows what's going to happen. Last week or recently, economists were saying, what's going to happen to the stock market? They don't know. There are no wise men. There's no one to trust. All you can do is, you know, as Robert Frost said, provide. The witch that came, that withered hag, to wash the steps with pail and rag, was once the beauty Abishag, the picture pride of Hollywood. And he goes on, what do you do? Make the whole stock exchange your own. If need be, occupy a throne, but no one could call you a crone. And I think that's what, provide. Everyone has to provide for himself because we don't know where we're going.
You know, when reading these earlier books, I was reading them or talking to you, you know, there seemed to be a stability here in this country that didn't necessarily translate outside of Europe. That's gone. I don't feel that anymore. I feel like when you're, you know, the line about bad governments everywhere and you just take care of yourself, that's become more and more true here.
Yes, it is. It is true here. I think we're badly governed, and we're not well represented either by Democrats or Republicans. As a matter of fact, Congress hasn't really done much for us. But people have begun to wake up to that fact, and unfortunately, become cynical. So they think, well, no one will help us. Actually, I don't think that's true. I think there are people who are capable of being leaders, but we haven't seen many lately. What you see is a lot of the kind of self-serving government that you see in little countries, in bad countries, in failing countries. We're failing, too, in significant ways. And it's the debt, but also getting other people to do things for us, getting China to manufacture things for us, getting India to explain how our computers work, just getting other people. It's like having Mexican illegal immigrants work for us and then despising them at the same time and saying, you can't come here. We want it both ways. We really have to do things for ourselves. I live on Cape Cod during the summer, and the service workers there on the Cape are from Jamaica or from places like the Ukraine, from Russia, from Kazakhstan. They come over as students to work in motels, to clean toilets in motels. We don't have local people who are willing to do it, or even people from Boston to come 65 miles to work in the service industry. What does that say about us? Just our work ethic is so bad. We're diminished by our unwillingness to work. So that's a worry. But I think another worry is just, you know, speaking for myself, people don't read as much as they say they do or as they ought to. So you mentioned names of people. It could be any name, Ford Madox Ford, Joseph Conrad, Henry James, Mark Twain, whoever it is. They don't know who you're talking about. And most people don't know and don't care. And we have politicians who don't read, who don't quote, who don't know poetry, who don't know their own writers. That's a bad thing. It's a bad sign. I don't mean to be saying we're dumbing down, but we need to work a little harder in all directions.
The last part of your trip was through Russia. When traveling through Russia, what struck me most about that trip for you was the free speech. They're talking like Americans.
Yeah. That's definitely true. They're talking. The country is the same, though. It's still governed in a very kind of secret, manipulative way by Putin and his people. But it's true. They can say and do anything. What I noticed about Russia, as I noticed in Albania, was when you give people freedom to say anything, they first become highly political, and they write diatribes against the government. They criticize. They talk very freely. Then they quickly realized that no one's listening, no one cares. The free speech to talk politically quickly becomes less of a novelty. And then that we get really interested in is magazines and publishing pictures of naked people, naked women, naked men, sex and porno. And that when I was in Vladivostok, I saw very little political debate, but lots of girly magazines. And I was thinking that the expression of, that political freedom, free speech, rapidly deteriorates into just tit and bum magazines.
Paul Theroux, a couple of final questions. The Elephanta Suite came out a year ago. It was fascinating for me to read that that book was written on this trip.
Yes.
Why did you publish it a year before?
I wrote the book to amuse myself in the evening. These are three novellas that Paul Bowles, whom I met in the Pillars of Pericles book, would have loved. Americans having a very, very bad time in India. I can't say that I have any insight into Indian life, but I know how Americans, just like Bowles, who's one of my heroes, understood. I actually wrote these novellas on trains, en route, in hotels. I had it finished before I started writing Ghost Train to the Eastern Star. So the Elephanta Suite, it's a suite in a hotel in Bombay. The stories all kind of originate from that suite, and it's Americans, I say, getting into big trouble. A travel book doesn't satisfy me on every level, but on the imaginative level, fiction does. So I finished that and published it before this. When I wrote Dark Star Safari, on that trip I was writing novellas, and I wrote a novella called The Stranger at the Palazzo d'Oro. I think I published it before, but I probably published it after. That was also a novella that I was writing on in Africa.
You know, the Elephanta Suite certainly is informed by the fact that you've just traveled through Turkmenistan, even if there's nothing in there.
That's true, and it's also, I had a strange encounter in Bombay. I met a woman who was traveling with three children, a small boy, a youngish girl, and then a say, 16, 17-year-old girl. And I said, "Do you want a cup of tea?" "Yes." We were talking, I realized she was a procuress pimping these children. And I put that incident into the Elephanta Suite, except that I carried it a bit further. It wasn't ended by my saying to the woman, "Well, maybe I'll see you sometime, I'll leave." But the man in the Elephanta Suite actually hooks up with one of the children, so to speak, and then corrupts her, corrupts himself.
That reminds me, in a way, of something like Blinding Light. Okay, what if this happened to me?
Oh, yeah, that's the operative thing, what if. Fiction is all about what if. My Other Life was what if. Mosquito Coast was what if. What if I took my family and went to Honduras and set up in Honduras? And Blinding Light, what if I took this drug in Ecuador, became blind, and then, well, I mean, I imagine that to be an erotic novel, but deliberately so. What if is the great question for fiction, but what if is not the question for travel. Travel is what you're seeing and what you're scrupulously recording. It's not what if I was somewhere else. It's I'm here. There's no what if.
Paul Theroux, now you've finished Ghost Train to the Eastern Star, and this takes several months. Are you working on a novel now?
Yes. I had an idea after I finished writing Ghost Train, and I was pursuing it. And then I went to India again last winter. I was in Bengal, in Calcutta, in Assam, far eastern India, and it's a novel about a crime in Calcutta, and that's what I'm working on.
You've been listening to an interview with Paul Theroux, whose latest book is Ghost Train to the Eastern Star. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.